I arrived at the reenactment area from the south. Police tape had been unwound across the street where Shakespeare Road ran into Cold Harbour Lane. Beneath the bridge that crossed the road perpendicular to the bridge I'd been stopped by on the day of the actual shooting. A policeman had been posted there to turn traffic away. I showed him the pass Naz had biked over to me 1 hour earlier. He let me through. Naz came over to greet me, but I paused beside the policeman and asked him, "Were you here on the day the shooting happened?" "No," he said. "I mean, not here, but just on the other side of the cordoned off area." "I wasn't there during that day," he said. I stared at him intensely for a few more seconds, then walked on with Naz. "Slept well?" Naz asked. I hadn't slept at all. My tiredness made the dappled pattern of wet and dry patches on the pavement stand out more intensely. The air was bright, but not bright blue. The sun was beaming from behind a thin layer of white cloud. Its light cast shadows and reflections from the bollards and the phone box and on the surfaces of puddles. "Whatever," I said. "How long do we have?" "We've got until 6 o'clock this evening," he said. "Get it extended," I told him. "They won't let us have more time," he said. "Pay them," I said. "Offer them double what we've paid already, and if they say no, then double that again. Is all the area between the lines of tape ours?" "Yes," said Naz. The cordoned off stretch ran between the bridge and the traffic lights I'd been stopped by on the first day, but of this area, only about a third was primary reenactment space. The other two-thirds were given over to backups, cars and boxes, tables, a big van from whose back doors two women were handing out coffee. The vehicles were all parked unusually, not flat against the curb, but willy-nilly right across the road, irregular. "When you see that, it's usually because there's been an accident," I told Naz. "Sorry," he said. "Or the fair," I said, "if it's on grass." He looked at me intently for a while. Then his eyes lit up and he said, "Oh yes, I see. I always liked the fair." "Me too," I said. We smiled at one another. Then I looked across our area. One of Frank's people, who I recognized from the building, was lifting replica submachine guns from a box and carrying them with another man towards the van the two women were serving coffee from. Another man was stepping from a dull red BMW he'd parked in the middle of the road beside the traffic lights. I looked back at the ground. Besides being layered and cracked, it was also plumbed, dotted with holes and outlets that had been placed there strategically when the street had first been laid. There was a small cover set into the tarmac that had "water" written on it, and another almost identical one that said "London Transport." A larger, rounder one set into a hydrant carried two strings of figures, EM124 and B125. Another simply bore the letter C. All these openings to tubes and pipelines, outlets and supply points, connections feeding back to who knew where. I saw we had a lot of work to do. "Where are the reenactors?" I asked. "Over there," said Naz. He pointed to the van. Three black men were hanging around behind it, drinking coffee. One of them was riding around in small circles on a red sports bicycle, trying to keep going without putting his feet down. "Is that the victim?" I asked. "Yes," replied Naz. "Stand him down," I said. "I'll take his place. Send the other two over to me." "And Naz?" "Yes." "I want to pay the people who've done all the organizing bits more." "Which ones do you mean?" he asked. "The people who've worked with you to get all the elements of this coordinated. Not the ones who actually do stuff, but the ones who make the other people's stuff all fit together. You understand?" "I do," said Naz, "but you're already paying them generously." "Pay them more generously then," I said. I pressed my thumb to my finger just where I'd stuck the knife in a few hours earlier as I said this. Money was like blood, I figured. I'd barely pricked myself. I had plenty more to give. Naz walked across to the three black men by the van. I saw him take the man who'd been riding the bicycle in circles to one side and talk to him. The man got off the bike, talked to Naz some more, then strode back to the van, reached in, took out a bag, and walked off towards the police tape. The other two, meanwhile, came sauntering over to me. I briefed them. "What I want you to do," I said, "is drive that BMW from over there beside the lights to just up there beside the Green Man pub." The Green Man is the name of the pub. "Your man talked us through the sequence," one of them said. He had a London accent and an affable smiley face. "Yes," I told him, "but you must park it just there, see? Exactly there. Its bonnet, front, its nose should be exactly there, no further forward than the end of the Green Man's second window. You park it there, then get out, you take your guns with you, and walk across the street firing at me." "At you?" the same man asked me. "Yes," I said, "I'll be reenacting the victim's role. You must walk across the street quite slowly, almost casually, firing at me. But don't fire until... Here, come with me." I walked them over to the phone box. "I'll start here," I continued. "I'll have just left this phone box when you pull up, or I'll just be leaving it. I'll get on my bike and start pedaling, riding in this direction, over here, in this direction, over here. That's when you should start shooting, as I come up to just here, where Movement Cars starts." That's the local cab company, "where Movement Cars starts." "Where should we stand?" the man asked again. "There," I said. I walked them back across the street to a spot just in the middle where the cracks branched out into a cell-like pattern of repeating hexagons. "Walk from the car up to here. No further than here, though. You can keep firing, but just stop advancing once you reach this spot. I'll try to turn into this road here, Belinda Road, and my bike's handlebars will twist under me, and I'll fall off, then get up again, and you shoot again, and I'll go down again. You guys should stand here while I do that. Stand here for a while, then go back to the car. Yes, do it like that. Do it just like that." The other man spoke now. Unlike his friend, he had a strong West Indian accent. "You're the boss," he said. I signaled over to Naz, who had been talking on his mobile, his cell phone. He came over to us. "Ready to go?" he asked. "Yes," I said. "What news on the time front?" "Working on it," he said. He called Frank and Annie over. They had Frank's man in tow, plus the man I'd seen handling the submachine guns with him a few minutes earlier. They carried one gun each. "Sid," Frank told me by way of introduction. "He's an effects man I've worked with on several films. He'll show our friends here how the guns work. You can take up your position if you like." "Okay," I said. But I stayed to watch this Sid explain the working of the guns. "Basically," said Sid, "they're like real 10mm Uzis with the chamber taken out. They'll make a nice bang. You've got two magazines," he went on, pointing to two metallic blocks Frank's man was holding, "which clip in under here. Look, try it." He handed the guns to the two black men. Frank's men handed them the magazines. They held both awkwardly. Neither could get their magazine to clip in properly. Sid showed them how to wedge the Uzi's butts against their stomachs just below the ribs and guide the magazines in upwards with their left hand from below, feeling for the slot and catch. They tried it a few times, nodding in satisfaction when they got it right. I envied them. I thought of asking to try too, but didn't want to get all self-indulgent. Besides, things were moving on. The coffee van was being shifted and the reenactment area cleared of all personnel. The two black men were being led towards the BMW and handed its keys. The bicycle was being brought to me. I took it, wheeled it over to the phone box, balanced it against the railings just beside this, then opened the phone box's door and stepped inside. The street sounds drained away and I was in a cocoon. The cabin had a little shelf in it. Perhaps this black man whose last moments I was reenacting had rested his address book on the shelf as he made his final phone call. Had the book been shabby, fat and bulging, yellow? I pictured it as yellow, tattered, but not fat. Then it went blue and thin, like those vocabulary books you get in school. On the window above the shelf, the figure of a messenger blowing a horn was stenciled in silhouette. Beyond it was the caged facade of movement cars with the words airports, stations, light, removals, any distance, painted on the window. The letters were painted on in white with a blue outline that had been extended outwards on each letter's right, so they seemed to be casting shadows. What did light mean? I picked up the phone's receiver. I didn't call anyone or put any money in the slot. I just stood there holding the receiver in my hand. Inside the cabin, it was quiet. There was no traffic passing by. My staff's vehicles, drawn across the road, formed an insulating wall between the reenactment zone and outside. In front of and between the vehicles, people stood quite still, all mine, a lot of people, looking straight in my direction at the phone box. Then I heard the BMW's motor start up, the sound of a spark plug firing a charge of compressed gasoline and of expanded gas shooting a piston off again and again and again, slowly at first, then faster, then after a few seconds so fast that the individual shots merged into a hum of infinite self-repetition without origin or end. It had begun. I saw the BMW pass the phone box on the far side of the street from the corner of my eye, and again in the metal of the cabin's wall, reflected. I set the receiver back onto its cradle and opened the phone box's door. I stepped out, turned my bicycle around and swung my right leg across its bar. The two men had backed the car into the space I'd shown them and were getting out. They'd parked it just right, exactly where I'd told them to. It was very good. The tingling started in my spine. I pushed off the pavement with my foot and let the bike roll forwards, its handlebars wobbling. As its front wheel passed a white foam cup lying on the ground, I looked up and to my left at the two men. They'd taken out their submachine guns and were pointing them at me. The man with the West Indian accent opened fire. His gun made a tremendous noise. The other man opened fire too, not half a second after the first one. The noise of the two guns together was quite deafening. The affable man with the London accent grimaced as he shot. The other man's face was expressionless, indifferent, the face of an assassin. The tingling grew more intense as I raised my buttocks from the bike's seat and started pedaling furiously past the grilled windows of movement cars down the dip into Belinda Road. The two men kept marching on me across Cold Harbour Lane, firing as they advanced. Just in front of the puddle at the edge of Belinda Road, I turned the bike's wheel sharply to the right and went over the handlebars. As I fell to the ground, a whole tumult of images came at me. The edge of the black bar with, there's another bar across the road, the edge of the black bar with no name, a streak of gold, some sky, a lamppost, tarmac, and the coloured patterns floating on the puddle's surface. After I'd stopped tumbling and become still, the patterns took the form of Greek or Russian letters. I looked away from the puddle up towards the men. They had stopped firing and were standing still, exactly where I told them to stand, by the hexagon cell pattern and the road. It was all good. The men were waiting for me to get up again. I pushed myself up with my hands and noticed they were numb. This was good, very, very good. I stood up and felt the tingling rush to my head. The two men fired again. I turned from them, dropped to my knees, then let my upper body sink back down towards the ground until my face lay on the tarmac. I lay there for a few seconds, quite still. Then I rolled over onto my back and stood up again. The two men were getting back into their car. "Wait," I shouted at them. They stopped. "Wait," I shouted again. "You shouldn't drive off. You shouldn't even walk back to the car. When you've stopped shooting at me for the last time, just turn your backs on me and stop." What should we do when we've stopped? The man with the London accent asked. Nothing, I told him. Just stop and stand there with your backs to me. We'll stop the whole scene there, but hold it for a while in that position, okay? He nodded. I looked at his friend. He nodded too, slowly. Good, I said. Let's do it again. We resumed our positions. Back in the phone box, I looked through the window. The BMW was turning round by the traffic lights beside the shortest man I'd noticed earlier. Just over half the crew and backup people had chosen that end of the area to stand at and watch from. Eight or so more were gathered at the far end, the end I'd entered from beneath the bridge. The cabin's glass was clear. The grille across movement car's facade was, now I looked at it more closely, actually four panels of grille, each panel being made up of three sections of crisscrossing metal lines. It looked like graph paper, with large square areas containing smaller ones that framed, positioned, and related every mark or object lying behind them, a ready-made forensic grid. Most of the grid's squares were pretty blank. The lower left-hand side one, though, the one closest to the movement, to the pavement at the corner of Belinda Road, had two bunches of flowers stuffed behind it. They were hanging upside down, wrapped in plastic. I don't know if it's the same here, but when someone's been killed, people put flowers at the spot very often. Wrapped in plastic. Two grid columns across were the painted words, movement cars, airports, stations, light, removals, any distance. They ran over all three of the column's larger squares. The N and T of movement ran into the next column, the column to the right. It was light removals, not light, then removals. I knew that already, but had just forgotten that I knew. The dull red BMW passed the phone box again. Again, I saw it twice, once from the corner of my eye and once reflected in the metal of the cabin's wall, only it seemed flatter and more elongated this time. When the driver turned the engine off, for half a second or so, I could make out the individual firings of the piston as these slowed down and died off. I opened the phone box's door, stepped out, and got onto my bicycle. Again, the tingling kicked in as I passed the white foam cup. Again, the two men took their guns out, and I pedaled furiously. This time, when the bike dipped from the pavement to the road, I felt my altitude drop, like you do on aeroplanes when they make their descent. The same tumult of images came to me as I went over the handlebars. A portion of the black bar with no name, a streak of gold, some sky, a lamppost, tarmac, and the puzzle with the Greek or Russian letters floating on its surface. I got up, let them shoot me a second time, went down again, and lay with my face on the tarmac, looking at the undercarriage of a parked van, at the patterned markings on one of its hubcaps. I lay there for longer this time than I had the last. There was no noise behind me, no footsteps. The two killers had remembered what I'd told them and were standing there quite still. I lay there on the tarmac for a long time, tingling, looking at the hubcap. Then I got up and we did it again and again and again. After running through the shooting for the fifth time, I was satisfied that we got the actions right, the movements, the positions. Now we could begin working on what lay beneath the surfaces of these, on what was inside, intimate. Let's do it at half speed, I said. The black man with the London accent frowned. You mean we should drive slower? He asked. Drive, walk, everything, I said. One of Naz's men was striding over to us with a clipboard in his hand. I waved him away and continued, everything, the same as before, but at half speed. Like in an action replay on TV, he asked. Well, I said, sort of. Only don't do all your movements in slow motion. Do them normally, but at half the normal speed. Or at the normal speed, but take twice as long doing them. They both stood there for a few seconds, taking in what I'd said. Then the taller man, the one with the West Indian accent, started nodding. I saw that his lips were curled into a smile. "You're the boss," he said again. We took up our positions once more. Inside the phone box this time, I examined every surface it had to present. My man, the victim, would have taken all these in, but then his brain would have edited most of them back out again, dismissed them as mundane, irrelevant, a mistake. Perhaps if he'd paid more attention to the environment around him, some association might have warned him of what was about to happen, even saved his life. He must have done something wrong, crossed someone, broken some code of the underworld. So if he'd looked more carefully at the cabin's metal wall and taken in the fact that the dull red BMW was passing slowly by, too slowly perhaps, and connected this with the last time he'd seen that car or its reflection, who he'd been with then, who knows? The stenciled figure on the windows, the messenger, knew something was up and was trying to announce this with his horn, to blare it out, a warning. His free hand, the one not holding the instrument, was raised in alarm. And then the silence, like the silence in a forest when a predator is on the prowl and every other creature's gone to ground except his prey, too tied up in his own concerns in sniffing roots or chewing grass or daydreaming to read the glaring signs. I stood with the receiver in my hand. The digital display strip said, "Insert coins." Outside, from beneath their grid, the windows of movement cars promised wide open spaces opening to even wider distances, airports, stations, and removals. Light. An empty green beer bottle sat directly beneath the hanging plastic-wrapped flowers. It seemed to be offering itself to them as a vase, if only they'd abandon their position in the grid, come down and turn the right way around again. The pavement, when I stepped out onto it this time, seemed even more richly patterned than it had before. Its stained flagstones ran past the phone cabin and movement cars to 3 or so feet before Belinda Road, then gave over to short staccato brickwork before melting as the pavement dipped onto the road itself into poured tarmac. It was like a quilt, a handmade patterned quilt laid out for this man to take his final steps across and then lie down and die on, a quilted deathbed. It struck me that the world, or chance, or maybe death itself, if you can speak of such a thing, must have loved this man in some way to prepare for him such a richly textured fabric to gather and wrap him up in. The killers had parked and were leaving their car. Behind them, the windows of the green man rose up, impassive. When my man, the dead man, saw the two men heading for him with their guns out, just as his apprehension that there was malice in the air finally gleaned from the arrangement of bodies and objects, from the grimace on the face of one man and the cold, neutral expression of the other, when this developed into full-blown understanding that they'd come to kill him, in this instant, this sub-instant, he would have searched the space around him for an exit, for somewhere to go, to hide. He would have pictured the space behind the windows, a space he'd seen before, the pub's lounge with its stools and pool table, the toilets behind this with their window leading to the yard beyond. His mind would have asked this space to take him in, to shelter him, and been told, "No, you can't get there without being shot. It's just not possible." It would have asked the same question of movement car's window and been told, "No, there's a grill here, and you couldn't pass through glass even if there weren't." It might even have looked to the holes plumbed into the street's surface, the water outlet and the London Transport one and the ones with strings of letters and even the one with just the C, and been told by each one, "No, you can't enter here. You'll have to find another exit." The two men had brought their guns out again and were raising them to point at me. I was swinging my right leg over the saddle of my bicycle, looking at them and the space around us. There was only one way out, the strip of pavement on the far side of Belinda Road. It led past the black bar with no name to the bridge and then away along Cold Harbour Lane. Separated from the road by a line of bollards, it looked like a sluice, a ramp, a runnel, one that opened to another place where there were no men with guns pointing at me. That's why my man had chosen that direction. By the time he'd reached the dip into Belinda Road, passing the puddle into which his blood would soon flow, he'd have realized that he'd never make it out that way. That's why he changed direction. I went over the bike's handlebars this time, serenely, calmly, taking time to greet the now familiar moments of landscape that came at me. The sky this time round had become totally consistent, clouds running together into an unbunched white continuum. The black bar's outer wall was detailed with reliefs and ridges and long lines of painted gold. The grille over the window of movement cars, reflected in the puddle and viewed from this angle, looked like the gridded ceiling of a dodgem ring. The letters were behind it. They weren't Greek or Russian at all. They were the A and R of airports, reversed by the water's surface. To the puddle's left, two bottle tops lay on the ground. I lay there looking at them. My man would have seen these too. They were beer bottle tops. He would have looked at them and thought about the men who drank these beers and wondered why it couldn't be him drinking them right now, these beers, off in some other place, around a table with friends perhaps, or at home with his family, instead of lying here being killed. Beyond these was a plastic shopping bag. On the bag's side were printed the words, "Got yours?" Just before I stood up for the last time, I murmured to the puddle, the white sky, the black bar, and the pockmarked littered road surface around me, "Yes, I got mine." My two assassins took their time in killing me. The slowed down pace at which they raised and fired their guns, the lack of concern or interest this seemed to imply, the total absence on my part of any attempt to escape, although I had plenty of time to do so, all these made our actions passive. We weren't doing them, they were being done. The guns were being fired. I was being hit, being returned to the ground. The ground's surface was neutral, neither warm nor cold. Lying on it once more, I looked over at the phone box. It was horizontal now. The stenciled messenger was on his side, his arms spread out, a forensic outline just like I would be within an hour or so. I turned my head the other way. Everything was tilted. Bollards leant away from me as they rose like plinths, like columns or temples, of temples or acropolises. The black bar's exterior ran diagonally down the street, the golden markings on it forming dots and dashes. Its fire doors were closed. Two blue and white signs on them bore the words, "Fire, escape, keep clear," two times repeated. When I let my head roll slightly back, a bollard hid all those words except one of the two escapes. Would my man have seen this just before the life dribbled out of him towards the puddle? Escape? Above the word escape, cloud, white and unbroken. There was no movement anywhere. I lay there doing nothing, staring. I lay there for so long that I wasn't even staring anymore, just lying there with my eyes open while nothing happened. Shadows became longer, deeper. The sky grew slightly darker, more entrenched. There was no noise anywhere, no noise at all, just the massed silence of whole scores of people waiting, like me, infinitely patient.